You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena toku ingoa, no mai, haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Hello, welcome to The Wire for Monday, the 27th of February. I'm your host today, Shimena, and I'm joined in studio by my producers, Tess and Ben. How are you guys doing today?
Yeah, pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, thank you. That today is Ben's first Wire.
To tell everyone that.
Yep. Sorry, Ben. No hiding from the listeners. But yeah, they've both done a very good job this morning helping me out, putting the show's content together. So today we're speaking about how ACT Party announced a policy in the weekend of rewarding self-improvement in prison. We speak to Green Party co-leader James Shaw for our fortnightly chat. This week we talk about the government's announcement around new regulation for poisons such as 1080 and also a new Green Party bill that will see aquifers being protected by law. We talk about the meaning of television ratings in our contemporary media landscape. What do they actually represent, and how much influence do they have over shaping the content that we see? And finally, we speak to Justin Milano, a coach and mentor to entrepreneurs and business starters. He's visiting New Zealand at the moment. So if you want to let us know some of the thoughts that you might have about any of the stuff that we cover today, please let us know. 309 3879 is the number to call, or 5395 is the number to text.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
The ACT Party announced a policy of rewarding self-improvement in prison at their conference in the weekend. The policy is designed to give prisoners the opportunity to gain literacy and numeracy skills, which will reduce their prison sentence, as well as help give them a better chance when they are released from prison. However, the policy has been criticised by some, who say it will only be applicable to a small portion of the prison community, and also that it's counterintuitive to ACT's punitive three-strikes policy. 95BFM reporter Tess Barnett spoke with David Seymour this morning about the policy.
The policy is that if you learn to read in prison, as well as other skills and numeracy, getting a driver's license, then you can have your sentence reduced by up to 6 weeks per year that you were sentenced. And the idea behind it is that we have the second biggest prison population per capita in the OECD behind America. And it's actually not that we send more people to jail or sentence them longer. The problem we have in New Zealand is that the same people keep coming back. 69% of people in jail in New Zealand have been in jail before on a previous sentence, and around about 50 or 60% are functionally illiterate, meaning that they can't do the basic things required to fill out a form, apply for a job, get a driver's license, etc. And our view is that those two statistics are connected. If we can start to give people an incentive to learn basic skills that will help them get out on in the world, we might stop having so many people leaving jail and coming right back. If you come in and you have a degree or you have School C or NCEA already, then you don't qualify, so you have to help other people in order to earn the same benefits and credits. So that's another benefit for the prisoners. But the main thing about it is all about incentives. And one of the problems that the Howard League have identified is that prisoners don't see the point in literacy, some of them at least. Now, one thing that we know about prisoners is that they want to get out of jail. And so we're giving them the strongest incentive we possibly could, but also the corrections department, who have been sometimes helpful and sometimes unhelpful to these types of programs, they need to free up bed space. So they have an incentive to get behind this too. And as a taxpayer, the idea of someone being in prison for 6 weeks less of a year and saving about $14,000 gets me pretty excited as well. So, you know, it's a win for prisoners, it's a win for taxpayers, and it's a win for reducing crime.
So critics have also said that it only affects a small portion of the prisoners, because some of the prisoners might have head injuries or mental health issues that means that they can't participate in these programs.
Yeah, and everybody that comes in has a different life story, different needs, and different things to overcome. I'll give you a classic example, a prisoner that Mike Williams from the Howard League spoke about on the weekend at the ACT Party conference was somebody who had a condition where the numbers jump all over the page, or the letters jump all over the page, in her words. It turns out the solution to this is to put coloured plastic on top of the page and change the wavelength and suddenly the letters stop moving from her point of view. Now, that's an example of something that can be easily overcome. Other people will need different types of therapy and tutoring and so on. But the fact of the matter that there are people with different starting points doesn't mean that we shouldn't actually let people start.
Cool. So what about this in relation to your three strikes policy? Critics have also said that it could be a bit counterintuitive. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and I can see why people would say that. How can you be tough on crime and want to rehabilitate criminals? They actually go together because the objective is ultimately to keep those of us who are law-abiding safe. And the way that we're approaching that is to actually give people good chances, give people a carrot that they can actually improve themselves, get out early and go on to lead meaningful lives and not clog up the jails. That's what we all want. But at the same time, we accept there are some people who are just going to keep putting people at risk, particularly with violent and sexual offences. And for people in that category, one time could be a mistake, twice could be unfortunate, but three times you should go down for the long haul because ultimately public safety is the issue. That doesn't mean we shouldn't invest hard in helping people in their earlier offending.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
That was ACT Party leader David Seymour speaking about the party's new policy that they announced in the weekend that entails rewarding self-improvement in prison. Next up, I chatted to Green Party co-leader James Shaw this morning for our regular chat on the Monday Wire. We started by talking about the government's announcement this weekend that they're set to introduce new nationwide regulations around the use of poisons such as 1080. I started by asking James if he thought this was a step in the right direction.
Yes, we do. As with all of these things, it comes down to the detail of what they're planning. But 1080 in particular has had quite a checkered history in New Zealand, and sort of 20 years or so ago, it was not being well used, and that has created quite a public backlash. So it is important that it is well regulated and well used. Yeah.
And so the government is saying that islands like Te Reti Matangi are only so prolific in bird life because of the use of these poisons in the past. Do you agree with this?
Yeah, I mean, the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment put out a report a couple of years ago that essentially said that 1080 is the least worst option. It's not the best option because there currently really isn't, a good solution to, permanent suppression of predators. But with 1080, what happens, obviously, is that you can get, you can suppress predators for about 6 months, but when it's on small islands like those, it means that you can actually get rid of them and then you can repopulate the islands with birds. Now, it's not great, because it is a poison, and it has been misused in the past, but it is good to see that kind of progress.
Hmm. So the Green Party is in support of this move, basically?
Yes, we are. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, broadly speaking, like I said, we're going to have to see the detail, and we're going to have to make sure that it does what it says on the tin. But, we are obviously in favour of better regulation of poisons like 1080.
So ultimately it's a good change.
Yeah, yeah.
And so critics of the move are saying that local communities weren't consulted around it and that alternative approaches such as setting traps were actually more effective at wiping out pests. What do you make of this?
Well, again, the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment did quite an extensive piece of research a couple of years ago, and it's true that in some parts of the country, trapping is quite effective, but actually what she found was that in many parts of the country, especially the more inaccessible parts of the country, it's not really a realistic option. And so there are some parts of the country where 1080 is, she said, the least worst option.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think...
I would like to say, though, that communities ought to be always consulted and included for the only reason that if you don't, then it creates a backlash.
Right, so you're saying it is problematic that perhaps these communities weren't consulted enough in this process?
Yes, could well be. Like I said before, 1080's got quite a checkered history in New Zealand, and that led to, quite a public backlash, and so that is something that we need to be very sensitive to.
Right, so I suppose it's more about the government needing to be able to mitigate those possible
that's
fears
right.
that people have
yeah,
around
right.
the use of it. So moving on to the new bill that the Greens announced yesterday, tell me about this.
Yeah, so, I mean, the key insight is that about 40% of New Zealanders rely on aquifer water for drinking water. And aquifers are, you know, for people who don't know, because we don't normally see them, they're basically large underground rivers. So a lot of us actually rely on aquifers for our fresh water. And they're not regulated in the same way as rivers, lakes and streams, above ground bodies of water. And so we have seen in places like Ashburton, where you had a bottling company, you know, bottling up fresh water and shipping it off overseas at the same time as the local community was on a restriction notice. Or Te Matatini, I think a week or two ago, was put on boil notices because their aquifer water was found to have E. coli in it. Is that actually what we're saying is that it's time that we started paying attention to aquifers as of national significance. And so we want to elevate the status of aquifers in Section 6 of the Resource Management Act so that, you know, development, you know, has to go through the same process for exploiting aquifers as they do for above ground bodies of water.
And so why have they not been prioritised by previous governments?
Well, I, you know, I think it's honestly, it's just one of those things where because New Zealand has historically been a very low population, low industrial base, we haven't really had to worry about it. But we have now gotten to the point where, you know, a combination of population growth and economic growth and industrialization has started to put real pressure on a resource that previously was able to replenish itself at a pace, you know, commensurate with how it was being used. But that has stopped being true. And so it's simply one of those things where we're now starting to notice the effects of the way that we do things. And we're saying, oh, well, you know, probably now is a good time to get on top of this.
Hmm. And do you have a sense of the sort of attitudes in Parliament about making aquifers the sort of priority?
Not yet, you know, because we only announced it yesterday. Andrew Little said that he thought that the Labor Party would be on board with it. It sounded like the kind of thing that would be consistent with their own environmental policy. But we'll be writing to the leaders of the other political parties as well to ask them for their support, and we'll just have to see what they come back with.
What do you see the sort of costs of an initiative like this will be?
Well, I mean, it's like anything. At the moment, say, you've got bottling companies that can take water out of an aquifer essentially for free, bottle it up and sell it overseas. And so what we'll be doing is saying that they've now got to go through the same resource management process to do with an underground body of water as with an overground body of water. And that doesn't reflect the true cost of the resource that they're taking, but it should mean that they have to think twice about, you know, their kind of business case and how they're going about it, and are they drawing too much water out of the aquifer.
Hmm. So it's kind of about prioritising local communities as opposed to people exploiting the water for business purposes?
Well, yeah, it's to say let's make sure that we're not drawing that collectively between us, you know, essentially local communities draw down on them, bottling companies draw down on them, and, you know, industrial irrigation schemes draw down on them. And if you've got all three of those competing for the same resource and no one's really thought particularly carefully about, you know, how that resource has been allocated, then you can sort of see what direction that's going in. So the point of this is basically to elevate it to a higher legal status, you know, higher sort of threshold, where we say, okay, you know, every time we do want to exploit an aquifer, we really need to consider that very carefully.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Green Party co-leader James Shaw speaking about the government's announcement around new regulation for poisons such as 1080, and also about a new Green Party bill that will see aquifers being protected by law. We'll be back after a quick break.
Questions are all around us.
Why do you yawn when other people yawn?
Learn.
Why am I going bald?
Learn.
What is the Matrix?
Learn.
Is BFM still relevant?
Learn.
Where'd I put my keys?
Here.
Magnets, how do they work?
Learn.
Find out all the answers with Ready, Steady, Learn. Every Tuesday morning with Hannah and a guest expert from the University of Auckland. Ready, Steady, Learn. 9:40 a.m. every Tuesday with Hannah on BFM Breakfast. Thanks to the University of Auckland.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That song that you just heard there was Mihiteria by Milk. Next up, my producer Ben is going to introduce the piece that he worked on this morning.
TV3's The Project debuted last night, replacing Story, itself a replacement of long-running 7pm current affairs show Campbell Live. This reflected a shift, also seen on 3's competitor TV1, away from traditional current affairs towards a mixture of information with entertainment. According to both channels, shows such as Campbell Live have become obsolete and fail to attract the lifeblood of commercial TV, ratings. However, should the sole aim of news programming be higher ratings? Do ratings represent real viewing figures? And what is the future of news in an increasingly profit-driven media landscape? First, I asked Associate Professor Jeff Leland at Waikato University just how the ratings industry worked.
Not very well. At best, they're a one-dimensional and flawed system that television clings to and radio to a certain extent, but they're, I would say sometimes they're a misrepresentation of the audience. They serve specific interests to advertisers, interests to schedulers, but not necessarily anyone else.
So is it possible to get a truly accurate representation of viewing figures?
Nielsen, and they're quite honest about it, candid about it, they say what they are measuring is presence in a room where a television set is on. And they're not saying that people are actually watching or engaging with it, or even if they're asleep. So that is only really, it's only sort of one-dimensional possibilities. I mean, I find the thing that's most interesting, have you seen Gogglebox?
I don't think so.
Yeah, which is a British, it was a Channel 4 program where they actually cite a camera in the living rooms of people who are watching television and capture their reactions and responses. And it's often very funny. It's actually been used as a research tool in the past. This is primarily for entertainment, but that isn't, to me, the most convincing kind of way of measuring audiences. Because, you know, merely watching is only, or the ability to watch is only one possibility.
What role do ratings play in programming decisions, and what does this mean for news and current affairs?
Oh, they're critical. They're really the thing, the measurement on which things survive or don't survive or get shifted around or get stuck into late-night slots or disappear completely. They're sort of the currency of television, but I think, you know, as the audience is increasingly fragmenting, they're becoming increasingly unstable or inaccurate or not much bloody value at all. Problem is, there's a lot of money, you know, apparently costs more than $5 million a year to run the rating system in New Zealand, the television ratings, and Nielsen that run it are a global company, they're a giant octopus all around the world. It's become the kind of established system, but it's not one that people seem to be willing to question. Privately, you know, I talk to program makers and they get incensed by what ratings claim about their programming. But with so much money and so many egos riding on it, you know, not many people actually question it.
What does the focus on ratings mean for news and current affairs broadcasting?
Well, you look at, you know, I've got... it's difficult to actually get the actual ratings information. You have to pay for it. A week later, it's not much value at all. But I have got access to Nielsen's report on 2016. And you look at the top 10 programs in New Zealand, and all it really says is that old people are watching television. So it's News, Fairgo, Country Calendar, Dr. Foster, reality programs about vets or dogs, and then at number 9, Mrs. Brown's Boys, and then Border Security, Australian program. So it's all TV1, dominated by TV1, and as someone said in the past, TV1's audience tends to be rusted to the dial. So other programs just don't get a look on.
And I guess just to finish off with, what is the future of news in a sort of rating-driven thing? Are we going to see more shows such as Seven Sharp or The Project, or can we see sort of traditional things like Campbell Live making a comeback?
Well, I'm holding judgment on the project because I've only seen it once or twice. I think that might draw a younger audience to news of a sort, you know, because there is news content amongst other flim-flam stuff. And it might pull people away from Hoskins, which would be a damn good thing. But then, you know, people say, you know, repeatedly, or they get their news from other sources, get their news online. There's a myriad of possibilities. The only thing that might change if some government is willing to actually put more money into non-commercial forms of television, but we will wait and see on that.
Cool. So that's all the questions I had written down. I guess if you had any final comments you'd like to make.
I've just written a piece for a journal, overseas journal, and it's kind of positing that actually now we can't really talk about the television audience or the television or even the radio audience. There's all kinds of audiences. And I sort of broke it down, had this kind of theory, I don't know if it floats or not, that's really there's four major blocks of audience these days. There's a child audience, but still uses television as its primary entertainment source, but increasingly looking for interactivity as well with content. There's an older audience, which I theoretically belong to, but don't really, who've grown up with decades of stability and certainty in the schedule and really continue to favour so-called linear television or, you know, scheduled television. They know, they want to know that something's always on the same time, the same channel on a certain day. And then there's the young audience, and all my students, who watch television in a very different way, in a very fragmented way, you know, repurposed online through YouTube, video on demand, all those kind of things. So they keep telling me they don't watch television. I said that you do watch television, just watching in a different way. And then there's the adult audience, which an educated audience, I would say, which I suppose I belong to, which really is not so much age differentiated, but looking for different content. And they're the ones that go to HBO, you know, or box sets, or do binge viewing, you know, all that wonderful drama that's coming out of Europe and America these days. So I think there's kind of that, and there's probably even more audiences as well, but those four I think are really, so when we talk about a television audience, we have to be thinking audiences all the time now.
I also spoke with senior media lecturer Peter Thompson from Victoria University about whether news could compete with more explicitly entertainment-focused media such as sports.
Well, in terms of audience appeal at any one moment, I mean, certainly sports events or a big movie are probably going to beat news. So if you're just looking at the ratings as a snapshot, I mean, and of course, any significant sporting event like the Rugby World Cup is going to beat the news hands down on that day. But overall, I mean, people are still going to go and look for news, and they may do so through a whole variety of media, including time shifting. Now, interestingly, about 2014, Nielsen started measuring digital audiences. It partnered with Adobe, and it started looking at websites, mobile apps, smart TVs, even game consoles, and started integrating those into the regular linear TV viewing patterns. And then just this year, I found out they partnered with Facebook to devise a new system that gives a whole range of social media metrics. And in fact, Facebook gives Nielsen all their data from their online activities. Not Messenger, but everything else is fed back into Nielsen so they can find out what people are talking about. I mean, same with Twitter, they pick up hashtags for key programs. So there's a much, much wider range of audience activity that's being surveyed. So in terms of your big event that's on TV that attracts a big audience, yes, that will obviously register, you know, through the standard ratings. But for peripheral activities and time shifting for other types of content, there's a much wider range of that kind of activity that's going to be picked up by these new systems.
What does the focus on ratings mean for news broadcasting?
specifically for news, well, if it's a commercial news outlet, then obviously it's still the main game in town, because your advertising levels are going to reflect your ratings. Now, the problem with that, as I say, is that you can't tell necessarily whether the person who's clicked on the people meter is actually in the room when the ads are on. But what we're seeing with these new systems is they're picking up a much wider range of news media activity. So, for example, newspapers, which used to rely just on circulation and readership figures, are now using online methodologies that can tell whether or not you stay on a particular web link for 30 seconds and read the headline, for a couple of minutes and read the whole story, and even whether you scroll all the way through. So as I say, there's a lot more sophistication in these new digital methods, but potentially that raises all kinds of questions about just how much information that you want to give away to these marketing companies. So to go back to the specific question of news, it's still a key driver for any commercial news operator. You know, making sure you get the clicks and the eyeballs or the ratings is essential. The problem they've been faced with is the fragmentation of those audiences across different platforms. And advertisers have become far, far more demanding in terms of wanting evidence for their audience reach. And by that, they don't just mean, are there a specific number of clicks, but they want to know that those are clicks from different people, or that if they're getting TV ratings, that those are different people being hit by the adverts. They don't want the same person watching the advert 10 times. They want 10 different people getting the advert once. They think that's much more effective. And they're getting some of that through these new social media metrics. So they're getting a much more accurate overview of how the audience is behaving.
Mm. And I guess just to finish off with, what is the future of news media? Are shows like, say, Campbell Live obsolete, and do they need to be replaced by shows like The Project?
Oh, well maybe I'm biased, because as you probably know, I'm a fairly strong proponent of public service broadcasting. So absolutely, I think in-depth news and current affairs are essential in the contemporary digital environment. The idea that just because everything is ostensibly online, you don't need to worry about the quality of content, somehow the internet will provide it, is quite frankly facile. And I worry about certain policymakers who seem to make this assumption, that just because we have ultra-fast broadband, therefore we should be able to get anything we like online. Well, of course, somebody's still got to provide the news content. And what we're seeing right across the board is commercial pressures driving the news media, particularly the newspaper sector, but other commercial news media as well, to making cuts in the budget, to making journalists redundant. And there's still a demand, and a significant demand, for high-quality news and current affairs. I mean, it was interesting in the case of Campbell Live that when push came to shove and it was under review, the viewership actually doubled. The 200,000 viewers that were apparently watching every night on a regular basis became 400,000. And I suspect MediaWorks was tempted to say, well, thanks for coming now. Where the bloody hell were you? That's a rating that would have kept Campbell Live going. So the problem is that we don't necessarily translate our requirements as citizens into consumer behavior that provides these commercial media companies with sufficient motivation, commercially speaking, to provide the quality of content. And that's one of the key reasons why I say that we need a strong public service broadcaster on every platform at the center of our media ecology. In respect to the overall news media ecology, I think what we're seeing at the moment is a culmination of a range of factors, including the deregulation of our media sector since the 1980s, the increased commercial competition across platforms thanks to convergence, the intensification of demands for financial performance in short time frames from overseas owners who really don't mind if they own a baked bean factory or a media company. And I'm thinking very specifically of Oak Tree Media here, who now owns Ironbridge, just a financial investment firm. They have no real interest in media per se. And those forces together are driving an intensification of commercial competition such that any kind of commercial underperformance, say in a TV schedule, any slippage in the ratings, you know, is not tolerated for very long at all. I mean, we've already seen the number of permutations of various programs that have replaced Campbell Live. I mean, ironically, I don't think any of them have actually done as well, although they may have outperformed on specific audience demographics. But that's happening right across the board. I mean, we're seeing cuts in newsroom budgets, we're seeing journalistic redundancies and casualization. There's an increased focus on what we might pejoratively call clickbait and populist stories that are there to generate traffic and maintain revenues. And some point, somebody is going to have to say, well, we need to intervene in this market to make sure that there's an incentive to provide high-quality news and current affairs, and that costs money.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was Waikato University's Jeff Leland and also Victoria University's Peter Thompson speaking about the effectiveness of ratings in contemporary media society. We'll be back after another break.
Hey, can you play the new Iri Cyrus song?
We just played that.
Oh. Can you play the other one?
Yeah, why not?
Here at BFM, we believe that variety is bad, and some albums are so good they deserve a proper airing. So that's what we're gonna do! Every Saturday during Totally Wired, NZ On Air Music presents Long Player, spinning a recently released local album in full, with interviews and anecdotes from the artists themselves. NZ On Air Music presents Long Player, every Saturday from 1 as part of Totally Wired.
Thank you.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
That song that you just heard there was Blue Filter by the Delia Derbyshire Appreciation Society. For our final piece today, Tess, my producer, is going to introduce it.
Justin Milano is kicking off the event Project 17, held at AUT campus, designed to inspire business starters and innovation. Justin helps exceptional entrepreneurs build thriving companies. As a serial entrepreneur and executive coach, he uses a unique blend of business coaching and leadership psychology to help entrepreneurs create breakthroughs. I spoke to him in the studio this morning. From my understanding, you're a coach and a mentor for people who want to start up new businesses or become an entrepreneur themselves. What would you say are the best things for becoming a good entrepreneur?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. So yeah, I've been an entrepreneur for the past 13 years, and I've also been an executive coach for the past 7 years. And one of the things I think is the most important skill sets of an entrepreneurial leader is to have a growth mindset. So a lot of entrepreneurs, when you go to start your business, you could never anticipate all of the ups and downs and twists and turns that you're going to experience as an entrepreneur. And so the ability to be able to navigate all of that with a high openness to learning and an ability to know that this is all part of your growth and development is really key. If you look at every great entrepreneur of our time, even people like Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, you know, he had no idea how to build an advertising business. He got the job right out of college, right? So he had to learn all these new things throughout the course of building that company. So the ability to learn and grow is actually one of the number one skill sets that investors look for in an entrepreneur.
In your opinion, why do businesses tend to fail? What would you say are the setbacks for these new entrepreneurs coming into business?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting question because when you talk to most people and you talk about the reasons for failure, you hear a lot of superficial things like, oh, we didn't establish product market fit. You know, we didn't really establish what customers really wanted, or the market timing wasn't right. All of these kind of things. And what we found at Good Startups, our company, when we coach entrepreneurs is that oftentimes underneath all of that are some deeper reasons for why entrepreneurs fail. Things like not being able to sustain the amount of fear and anxiety that they experience on a weekly basis. Burnout. You know, you're building a company and you just can't do it anymore. The long hours, the fatigue. And a lot of times too, people are building their companies for the wrong reasons. So they're motivating from a place of trying to prove their self-worth. Right? Like if I create a company that's really successful, then that makes me successful as a human being. And from that type of motivation, what happens is that you choose to build companies and you make decisions on the type of products and services that you offer the world that you think are right for the world, but they're not actually aligned with your true passions and what you're uniquely designed to bring to the world. So it's really important that you get clear on what's actually motivating you and really motivating from a place of being of service to society and other people.
Yeah, well, that smoothly brings me into my next question, which is, so I understand that you're big on emotional resilience with teaching that in your entrepreneurs or your business leaders. So what would you say is most important about that, and how does someone achieve that?
Yeah, well, so one of our venture capital partners who sits on our board, he actually has a portfolio with over 100 entrepreneurs. And they were going, hey, you know, we give them money, we give them strategy, we give them connections. What aren't we giving them that's going to help them be successful? And you know what the number one thing that rose to the top was? Sunday night is their biggest challenge. Being a founder and a CEO, sitting up on a Sunday night and facing the week ahead and all the challenges. Are we going to have enough money? Will I be able to hold on to these team members, right? Will this new product or service, this new product launch, will it work? And so there's so much anxiety and fear and kind of loneliness that CEOs experience. And it's not talked about a lot, but they are experiencing it. So one of the things that's really key is having a healthy relationship with your fear and anxiety. It's one of the greatest entrepreneurial skill sets because it allows you to see these things not as challenges and threats, but as opportunities to really step into more creativity and innovation for how to solve those problems. And if you do that on a consistent basis, the entrepreneurial journey becomes less like a roller coaster and it becomes a little bit more of a smoother ride. So this is some of the things that we help entrepreneurs with, is really dig deep to help them understand their fears and anxieties and how to channel them into more creativity and innovation.
So what are your thoughts on leadership? So what would you say are the main skills of being a good leader that are most important that you coach as a mentor yourself?
Yeah, well, one of my favorites, that's a great question. So one of my favorites is a lot of leaders believe that they need to have kind of a hero complex. Like, I need to know it all. I need to know all the answers, right? And they try to maintain that image and that identity as they're operating their company. And what that actually invites is other people in your team to do the same. So no one's actually talking about the real challenges that are going on, the things that you need support with. And so you start to kind of gloss over these really important things. So what I find is that leaders that are able to show up and be real and be vulnerable and be honest and straightforward with their team members, they promote that throughout the organization, and that opens up a ton of creative capacity. So I always say to, you know, founders and CEOs, like, hey, you know, you don't need to know it all. That's why you put support all around you, and that's why you build incredible, remarkable teams. So that kind of leadership, where you're honest and vulnerable on a regular basis, is really key to success.
What are your thoughts on New Zealand so far as a place for new businesses?
So I have been traveling all throughout New Zealand. I've been doing talks now in Wellington at, you know, Creative HQ, and the Greenhouse down in Christchurch, and on the West Coast in Westport with a lot of small business owners. And now I'm up here at the Auckland University of Technology and doing talks tomorrow in Auckland. And I can comfortably say that this is a incredibly brilliant, amazing entrepreneurial ecosystem. There's a lot of great support systems. There's a lot of great people behind all of this. I've seen everything from, you know, small business communities, local economic development agencies. I've had the opportunity to connect with the deputy prime minister just randomly when I was over on the West Coast, all the way to the incubators, the accelerators, and so forth. There are so many people that are working to create a thriving entrepreneurial ecosystem. It's very exciting, and it's so exciting that actually our company is actually looking at joining the Global Impact Visa program, which is basically a program to bring entrepreneurs from around the world to build companies here. And we've just found that this would be a great place to build a company alongside our operations in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. So if you're a young entrepreneur out there and you're thinking about where to build your company, this is a great place to do it.
So my last question for you today is, what are your best tips for new business starters?
Yeah, well, what I see for people when they're first starting a business is that there's a lot of fear and anxiety that prevents them from taking those steps. And that's perfectly natural. If you're experiencing that, that's fine. It's part of the game. Right? So I invite you to go ahead and take those steps, and also realize that almost every entrepreneur I talk to, they always look back and say, if I knew what it would take to build my company when I first started, I probably wouldn't have started it. But what I can tell you is that starting a company, going through all the learning and the growth that's required to be able to bring a company to market, is one of the most joyful experiences that I've ever had in my life. And so I say, go for it. But the important thing is that as you go for it, make sure you surround yourself with the right mentors, the right advisors, the right coaches, and organizations like us at Good Startups, or Co-Starters, which is another great small business organization here. Surround yourself with the right support systems, because you're not gonna know it all. There's gonna be a lot of things you face you've never faced before, but just trust that you can navigate all that.
That was Justin Milano, who's kicking off the event Project 17, being held at AUT campus tomorrow night. The event starts at 5:30 and tickets are available from Eventbrite.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that wraps up the end of this week's show. Thank you to everybody who spoke with us for the pieces that we played today. David Seymour, James Shaw, Jeff Leland, Peter Thompson, and Justin Milano. Thank you both to my two producers today. Thank you to Ben and Tess. You both did a really great job today. And of course, thank you to everybody who tuned in. We'll be back again next Monday with some more stuff. And actually, I'll be back on Wednesday with The Wire again. So yeah, talk to you all then.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.